It's another edition of the Talking Mets Podcast here on this Wednesday, February the 11th, 2026. Of course, I'm your host, Mike Silva. You can check me out all the time at thetalkingmetspodcast.com. You can get me on X at Talking Mets, no G, and on your favorite podcasting service, Apple, Spotify, pretty much whatever podcasting service you desire. If you want to interact with me, Mike Silva at TalkingMetsPodcast.com, no G, Mike Silva at TalkingMetsPodcast.com. You could also get me, and I hope you join me, at the new and improved TalkingMetsPodcast.com. Updates on the show, chat for free over to our Substack account, premium content, all at TalkingMetsPodcast.com. And I want to thank the good folks on the Believe Network for supporting this show. Welcome to the Pitchers and Catchers edition of the Talking Mets Podcast. The grind has begun. We put the hot stove behind us. Pitchers and catchers officially report today. Full squad in about another week. We're about 10 days from the first spring training game. And yes, we may be actually thawing out of the cold here in the Northeast, here in New York. And we could see the regular season. We could see baseball right in front of us. The Super Bowl, the football season's behind us. And what a way to kick it off with a quick State of the Union with me. What better way to kick off this? What really is, for some of you as baseball fans, kind of like a holiday, or with Punxsutawney Phil not seeing his shadow, it's our version of Groundhog Day, where actually, yes, we don't see any shadow here with Punxsutawney, or we do see any shadow. I don't even know how it works. We're seeing baseball here over at the Talking Mets Podcast, and I guess how I'm going to approach this is this is kind of the warm-up. This is kind of like the little appetizer for Sunday's show when we really start to get into the meat and potatoes. And all spring, with the whole Grapefruit League roundups, the things that we do normally here on the show, we just kind of break down the roster. We look at some of the positional battles, some of the interesting names in camp, and, of course, start building. This is the building the roster phase. We always talk about the phases that we've created, or I've created here over the Talking Mets Podcast, the getting to know you phase, the what does this team need phase, the go get it done phase. Of course, then there's the postseason. But right now, this is kind of like the preamble to the getting to know you phase, because you're building the roster. And before on Sunday, before we start to really dive into, okay, these positional battles and what do the kids have in the tank? Is Alvarez and Beatty and Vientos, are they ready to take the next step? Is McClain ready to build on last year? What about the Ryan Cliffords and the Jack Winnegars? What about Kodai Senga and the veterans like Sean Manaea making a comeback here? Are the Mets going to go with six starters? It already came up during David Stern's press conference yesterday. There's some interesting bullpen battles emerging. The health of the club. Who's going to take the last spot on the roster out of camp? All these things that we're going to talk about, and obviously names that are going to emerge and maybe just pass through briefly before we never talk about them again. All winter, and some of this stuff has been discussed, and then all winter we've been discussing about building the roster and improvements to the roster. And there's some faces that we're going to actually be getting to know initially here in Port St. Lucie with Bo Bichette and Jorge Polanco. Names like that, Freddy Peralta on his walk year, looking to get a big contract, looking to build on his breakout season last year in Milwaukee. All these conversations, all these things that are going to dominate our show, likely from the jump, the one conversation we never had all offseason, or maybe we took for granted, and maybe the first day of Pitchers and Catchers, or the day before the first day, both of these players were highlighted in a way that maybe they created some questions. The Mets are built right now in the short term, and to a certain degree, 50% of it on the longer term, on having two top 10 positional players. Those are their linchpins, those are their anchors. When you look at the offensive part of the roster, Juan Soto and Francisco Lindor are those linchpins. There's really no other star, unless Alvarez breaks out or Beatty breaks out. Polanco's a component player. Yeah, Bo Bichette is a star. I think Bo Bichette is a very good player that may be hovering into starhood, but he's not, I would say, on the level. He's not a top 10 player in baseball. I don't know if it ever will be, especially as he moves to a corner position. You know, maybe there's a next level with him, especially after the great second half playing in the World Series with Toronto. But when you look at the Mets roster, it's these two top 10 stars and then a combination of components slash very good players around them. And that's okay. That's how you build a team. But the team takes a different turn if you don't have those two top 10 stars. Because let's be frank, maybe Carson Benj is on the way. Maybe there are other trades to happen. Maybe there are other names we're not even talking about. But if one or both of those players are not living up to expectations in both Soto and Lindor, it's a whole different conversation. The whole formula, everything that we've been talking about, hoping for, kind of goes by the wayside. And I don't think in the next 6 months as we play or talk about 162 games in 180 days, 200 plus days of the season, if you start adding in postseason and whatnot, I don't think that's going to change much in the short term, maybe the long term. But on the first day of pitchers and catchers, the conversation is about their highest paid player, their star, their Hank Aaron, Ted Williams, whatever elite hitter in the history of the game you want to talk about. Moving positions, actually a positive thing with Juan Soto moving to left field. Juan Soto during the offseason, that's a conversation that we actually brought up here, if you remember, in context when Cody Bellinger may have been lightly considered. It's always debatable how serious the Mets were about him. But one of the things I said is, look, if you could get a player like Bellinger who has a good arm, could play good defense, could play the outfield at a higher level, move Soto to left. From a standpoint of Citi Field, with right field being quirky, the Sun Field, the nook and crannies out there in that old Pepsi corner or whatever, the Mo Zone they used to call it, moving him to left field makes a ton of sense. He can't be any worse than what Brandon Nimmo, who is declining with various injuries and health situations out there. And I think this has been, and we've talked about this as a run prevention situation, this has been something that when you build a team defensively, it's not like you need a gold glover in every position. You want competency in every position. You want average to above average in every position. You don't want Dick Stewart at first, or now maybe Mark Vientos will become the poster child for third base, or Glenn Helen Hill type playing the corners. And I'm sorry for those of the audience if I'm dating myself, but look those guys up when it comes to the glove. But you want strong up the middle defense. You want competency in the corners. In right field, you want somebody who has a good arm. And you want someone in the corners at first base and third base to be competent, average, and more than likely be more offensive-oriented when it comes to their game. And if moving Soto to left field is going to make him more comfortable, make him a better overall player, if you look at the metrics, and I'm not a big defensive metrics guy, but if you look at the metrics, when he first came into the league with the Nats, he was a pretty solid left fielder. And his year in San Diego when he played left field, he wasn't bad. He actually, I think, graded out pretty well on the metrics. This might be a positive move. I don't think Soto is a lazy player in the outfield. I don't think he has or lacks skills to play the outfield. I just don't know if it's a combination of instincts, focus. Maybe sometimes playing the outfield, you kind of get bored out there. There's a lot of different things. But Soto is somebody that probably in the long term is more of a hitter, might be trending towards DH as his legs go. We are way, way, way off from that. I mean, he's in his prime. Soto is 26 years old. He's not going to be 27 until the end of this year, October. He's smack in his prime. There's not going to be any, hopefully, knock on a lot of wood here, injury issues with Soto. So on a lesser note, when it comes to the news about the stars, the two top 10 linchpins that the team has, Soto's the lesser of the concern. The move to left field is nothing but something that could be a positive. It's a positive from all standpoints on the defensive side. If it makes him more comfortable, it makes him a better hitter because he's not worried about his glove. Not that there was any indication that he was. All for it. And I don't think there should be much discussion because that's where he belongs. Now, does that change him in terms of his ego and things like that? I can't answer that. I doubt it. I think the more you learn about Soto, I think he's a quiet guy. I think he's a serious guy. I think he's a guy who's all business about the game. I don't think he likes to get involved in some of the extracurricular nonsense about the game, which has actually become a criticism for him or brought up questions about him caring. But here's a guy who, high-profile right fielder, could have easily said no. But hey, team wants him left. He's going to move to left. Unless there's something I'm missing, this is a non-story and it's a good thing. Now, the bigger concern, and I know what everyone's going to say, and I'm going to say it too. I retweeted it over on X, Dr. Jesse Morse, talking about the Hammett injury. The Mets don't seem concerned, but this stress fracture of the Hammett, which the only thing that the doctor said that I was a little surprised at, I have been told historically that those injuries in the hammock do hurt a little bit with your power or with your offensive game a little bit when you're first coming back and recovering from it. Remember, the game of baseball is as much wrist action and you know, hand-eye wrist action coordination than it is strength and muscle and all those things. I mean, hitting the baseball, you could be the strongest person in the world. If your mechanics stink, you don't have the proper load and what have you, you're not gonna hit. I mean, look at so many times you watch a slow-mo of a hitter when they flail or they're not out there executing at a high level. Their swing looks ugly, and it has nothing to do with their strength. It just those they're not in sync. And something small like this can wreak some havoc. Now, when you look at Lindor's game from last year, and it's his left hand, so it would impact him more as a right-handed batter. It's his left hand, so it's his glove. You start to wonder if some of the small things that annoyed you about Lindor, his lack of offense right-handed. I mean, he was about 10 to 12 points below what you'd expect. He was below 700 OPS right-handed last year. And it wasn't talked about. And look, I didn't talk about it, but he was below that. And there was some small, clumsy things that we saw at short that maybe this injury has been lingering for a while. Now, I know what some people want to hear and talk about. And you're not going to get that here. You're going to want to hear about the WBC and him trying to sneak through on the insurance and getting caught and he's not a team player. I mean, how stupid. I mean, this is where, thank God for a lot of the content that's out there, including this show, not to pat myself on the back, because when the first few days of spring training are filled with fake controversy like this WBC stuff that will come up, and Luke Weaver's bag, a bag that, you know, who cares what bag he comes to spring training with, tells you that we've hit a wall in terms of conversation about the sport. But I digress. So, you know, here's Lindor coming in, has this injury, more than likely is going to probably need surgery, going to be out 6 weeks. I would anticipate maybe he doesn't come north with the club and maybe he's out the first 2 weeks of the season. Remember, the season starts a little early. It starts at the end of March. So maybe you don't see Lindor till the second week of April. So maybe he misses the first 10 days to 2 weeks of the regular season, something like that. Not the end of the world. I know it's going to elicit panic. I know it's going to drive people nuts. I know that if the Mets get off to a slow start offensively and they have Brujan or Kessinger or whoever the hell else they're going to try to plug in at short, Mauricio, and they're struggling, it's going to be a deal. You don't want to not have your veteran, maybe your captain, gold glove shortstop, pseudo gold glove shortstop, Energizer Bunny at the top of the lineup. You don't want to be missing him for a couple of weeks. And look, if he does go for surgery and he does sit, that's news, because since he came over to the Mets from Cleveland, outside of an oblique injury he had back in his first season, 2021, which limited him to only 125 games, he's played 161, 160, 152, 160 throughout his time with the Mets. The 152 is because of a back injury he had, if you remember, at the end of 24. Acuna came and subbed in for him. So Lindor plays, and Lindor plays through pain. What did he broke his toe a few years ago in a closet. So he's not a guy that is going to sit out. Now, maybe he says he could play through it. I don't think that's smart. I think if the surgery is a possibility and you get it fixed, this is the time of the year. I think the bigger concern, if you're a Mets fan and you're the Mets, is you have to start to wonder. And we're now in, what, year six of Lindor? Yeah, one, two, three. Year six of Lindor. I think he still has another 6 or 7 years left on his deal. And you have to wonder, as he's age 31, he's going to be 32 at the end of the year in October. You start to look at historically great shortstops. And I think the conversation of how much elite time you have on Lindor is fair. This is not a big deal injury, Hammett injuries. But when you start to look at the last 2 years, back in 24, Hammett injury now. As a player enters his late prime, plays a demanding position like shortstop, is at the top of the lineup, has speed as part of his game, so he's out there scoring runs, wreaking havoc on the bases, stealing bases, all the things. There is a certain level of wear and tear, especially when you start to look at a player that plays every day, plays a demanding position, plays it every day, very rarely gets taken out, maybe for an inning or two in a blowout. When you have 162 games in 180 days, yeah, he's getting days off like the rest of the team, but he's not taking any load management days. This is not like the NBA over here. So you have to start to think, well, how much left in the tank does Lindor have? And if he declines, where he's still very good and still an important part of the team, how do you make up that offensive production? And if he declines where he's not a Gold Glove shortstop or he's a little bit less than that, how does that impact the team at a premium position where, let's face it, you want to talk about run prevention, it starts with shortstop at center field. That's where your run prevention on any ball club starts. You want to throw behind the plate? Sure, from an arm perspective. With the automatic strike system, I don't know if framing is going to be as big of a deal anymore. But all you have to do is look at history and say, yeah, you're starting to stare at the end of the elite road of Lindor in the next maybe 2 to 3 years. Don't believe me? Look at Barry Larkin's baseball reference page. Look at Alan Trammell's baseball reference page. Look at Derek Jeter's baseball reference page. Now, I'm not saying he's going to fall off the cliff, and I'm not saying the Hammond injury is a problem, because it might just be something that by tax day, by April 15th, we've forgotten about. And certainly by the dog days of summer, when we're talking about the trade deadline, hopefully the Mets are ramping up for locking down a postseason spot of some sorts, it's probably not going to be part of the conversation. But it's another sign that as a player hits a certain age, there are little things that show you that the check engine light is coming on, more maintenance is needed. And even if it's 1% less this year, 2% less performance next year, you look up after 2 or 3 years and 100% elite player might be 95, might be 90. And then all it takes is, look at Jeter when he had that horrific, what was it, broken leg or broken arm injury in the playoffs. What was it, 2012 or something like that? He was never the same again. Now, he played, and Jeter was another one. Played a demanding position, played it all out, played every day, started to decline. Yeah, he had a great season at age 35, but he was also in a lineup with A-Rod, with Teixeira. He was not a top 10 player at that point. You were not asked to be a top 10 player. I mean, Jeter was long after he was north of 30. Now, he was arguably not even the top. I mean, even though that would be baseball heresy, wasn't even the top two on the Yankees at times. When A-Rod was on his game, when you had Teixeira, when you had those elite hitters, they were better offensive players than Jeter. So, you know, even you could argue Gary Sheffield was too. But that's the concern you have. Aligning Soto, aligning Lindor, aligning the rest of the roster around these guys. And if Lindor now is starting to have the little aches and pains, instead of playing 160 games, he's down to 135, then that begs the other question. And it changed your mind, I think, a lot on who's the next shortstop up. And I think it makes Ronnie Mauricio that much more important. Now, Mauricio has shown no inclination to have the baseball mind to adapt to the game. He, and we've talked about this, he's a toolsy guy. He's got a great body. Sometimes he has a beautiful swing, but he hasn't learned how to hit right-handed. At times he's been fooled and he hasn't adjusted at the plate against the elite pitching. And even though he had, or his metrics graded out very well at third base, I mean, like top in the league at third base, how does that translate to short? We don't know. We haven't seen enough of him at short. Big guy, good hands. I'm sure he's going to perform admirably. And I've said, and I've wrote about this, and I probably have said it in other shows, Mauricio this year is kind of in a make or break with the organization. Either he's going to push his way into a hard decision where the Mets are going to have to find a spot for him on their team, and a spot where he plays every day, not once a week, and sits for periods. Or he's going to play himself into being traded for a piece they need, or he's going to play himself out of this whole thing. Now, if Lindor is hurt and you know he's going to be out 2 weeks and Mauricio could come north and he could play short, that's the guy you want to bring, not a Brujan or some kind of depth infielder. I'm not interested in that. Kluck or any of these other guys that's names are going to come up that you're going to say, hey, you know, can they make it? And really, even without Lindor's injury, I started to look at the roster. I started to look at that last spot because we've been debating, you know, can MJ Melendez, who was just acquired, make it? The Mets don't have an around-the-horn guy. I mean, Beatty's not a shortstop from what I understand. I mean, can Simeon move back over there? Probably not. And do you want to mess around with your Gold Glove second baseman? I guess Polanco, that's a more interesting conversation. Polanco maybe could move over there temporarily, but don't you want him playing as much first base as possible? You did acquire him for some of the versatility, so maybe that's there. But you don't have a lot of that. And it may change the construction of the roster because historically the Mets haven't really worried about a backup shortstop. They could have done in the past the McNeil as an injury emergency replacement. Or last year they had Acuna most of the year, and you knew your defense was not going to drop at all with Acuna at shortstop. The offense would. And the one time you asked him to step up when he first got brought up, he actually filled in quite well for Lindor during that week against Philly and D.C. So I think this is not a thunderbolt yet. This is an early season annoyance or early spring annoyance. Thunderbolts would be, hey, Lindor's out 6 months, and Lindor's out for the year, Lindor's out to the All-Star break. We're, again, knocking on a lot of wood. But I think it's fair for the first conversation we have as we break the cellophane off the 2026 season here on the Talking Mets holiday of pitchers and catchers reporting to wonder how much is left in Lindor's tank and how does this team look as if Lindor is starting to have little things that take him off the field? Let's say best case scenario is he plays every day and he's Lindor of 160 games for the next 2 to 3 years. I mean, there is precedent. Barry Larkin, Jeter, things like that. They still play. They play at a very high level. You know, maybe he has a couple of nagging things like this that keep him out a week here, an IL stint here, a weekend series there. I got to take a day game after a night game off. I'm not playing 160 games anymore. I'm down to 145. Not the end of the world. Not the end of the world. Just got to make sure those days, the drop-off isn't significant enough where it causes havoc on the defense and it doesn't create a big black hole to a big level, a great level with the lineup. But I think long-term, I think that the conversation and one of the things that you want to see, and that's where a bench comes into play here. Or maybe even, look, you're renting Bo Bichette right now. You're not owning him, really. He's on a one-year deal, let's face it. Forget the opt-in. Is Bo Bichette somebody that shows you he's ready to jump into that elite status? Maybe, and I don't know, when the defense is a question, but if his offense is ready to take a leap, especially here on a big stage in New York, is he ready to take some of that top 10 elite superstar responsibility? I mean, I think that's why they went after Kyle Tucker. And then, better yet, less likely Beatty, who's probably going to play the McNeil around the field. But is Francisco Alvarez ready to do that? Is Carson Benj, everybody keeps talking about him, the Mets are excited about him, he's going to get a real shot to be the starting right fielder now that Soto's over and left. Is Carson Benj legitimately, within 12 months, similar to how Wright and Reyes jumped on the scene 20 years ago, ready to take that mantle on? Remember, when Wright and Reyes came up, they were prospects. They were there was a lot of optimism around them. But within a year, year and a half, they were the cornerstone of the franchise. Of course, there was Beltran, and they acquired Beltran. But they were the cornerstone. They ripped that from a Piazza. They ripped that from that old guard. And that's what the team was for, you know, six years at that point. So is Benj this version of Wright? Is Alvarez ready to jump in like Reyes did? I guess we'll see. So I think that's really the question. That's the conversation. I think realistically, you have to start to prepare that age 32, 33, 34. Lindor's next 2 to 4 years are pretty much where you have to leverage whatever he's got left at a top 10 positional player status. Not going to say he's going to fall off the cliff and not be valuable. Barry Larkin, his late 30s, was a good player. Mets tried to acquire him in 1999 before Mike Bordick. He would have been interesting how things would have turned out. In 2000, they tried to acquire him. Would have been interesting how things would have turned out even at that point in his career. But then you have the Alan Trammells, the Miguel Tejadas. I mean, not that Tejada is a Hall of Famer, but a very good shortstop, fell off a cliff a little bit after age 32. They just weren't really everyday elite players anymore. And when I say fall off a cliff, that doesn't mean that they're zeros. That means now they're very good, maybe at times and stretches, component players. And that's not what the Mets need right now. So I think that's the message or the warm-up here as we have this State of the Union on this Wednesday. Holiday for Talking Mets podcast fans, pitchers and catchers reporting. So what's next? Well, what's next is on Sunday, we're going to start breaking down this roster and really talking about what we're going to be looking for this spring. over the next couple of days. We'll give you some premium content, maybe talk a little bit about the bullpen. Mets acquired an interesting left-handed arm from Chicago yesterday. I'm really intrigued by this Brian Hudson. Mets may have stolen a nice little arm that I think the intent is to be a placeholder until AJ Minter's back in May, but maybe he could be more, and maybe there's something that they could do with him. He's still very young. And then, you know, we'll continue to day in and day out, have fun with this, talk about the team. You know, what's going to be next for those that listen to the show? Well, we're going to try to have every week 3 to 4 premium content pieces in between the show to give value to those who subscribe and pay for premium content, but also to stay connected and maybe talk about smaller issues that would fall off the cliff on the weekly show. Probably more audio content, things like that. It's going to be a combination. If I feel inclined to give you a written piece, short or long, if it makes sense for the topic, I'll do it. If it makes sense to come to you with a 10-minute short over on the Extra Innings Premium Content, I'll do it. And then, like today, it's a Talking Mets holiday, pitchers and catchers. Everybody, you'll get the commercial-free version of the premium subscribers, and then everybody else gets, unfortunately, I know everybody hates commercials, but they help us keep this thing going, and you'll be able to listen to that as well. So that's the plan. More to come. We have officially kicked off the grind here. We've officially kicked off the journey of the 2026 season. All right, that's it. Of course, you can check me out all the time at the TalkingMetsPodcast.com. You can get me on X at TalkingMetsNoG and on your favorite podcasting service, Apple, Spotify, pretty much whatever podcasting service you desire. If you want to interact with me, Mike Silva at TalkingMetsPodcast.com, NoG, Mike Silva at TalkingMetsPodcast.com, and come join me at the new and improved TalkingMetsPodcast.com. Chat for free, premium content, updates on the show. You can even talk to me, contact me, all at TheTalkingMetsPodcast.com. And I want to thank the good folks from the Believe Network for supporting this show. I am your host, Mike Silva. Enjoy your kicking off Pitchers and Catchers Day, our Talking Mets holiday today. Till Sunday, we'll be back then. Take care, everybody. Meet the Mets. Head for the